1 week to go until the Florida presidential primary elections. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Mike Miller, sitting in once again for Melissa Ross, and thank you for listening. Just ahead, everything you need to know before you head to the polls. If you'd like to join us on the phone, our telephone number is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Then later, this month's First Coast Connect book club selection. That and much more ahead. But first, this hour, if they haven't already done so via early voting, Florida voters will be heading to the polls 1 week from today on March 17th. But first, voters in six other states, including Michigan, will cast their votes tonight. How could tonight's outcomes impact us here in the Sunshine State, and what should voters know before they make their selection? Obi Umana, a Jacksonville-based attorney and political consultant, and Daniel Cronrath, who's a professor of political science at FSCJ, joins us now with more. My questions to you, have you voted yet, and are you planning to? And what would you like to know before you head to the polls? You can call us at 549-2937, email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweet us, or comment on our Facebook page to let us know. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. It's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me on.
Good morning, Mike.
Like to just start with tonight's voting, of course. People are calling this Super Tuesday 2 or a number of other names that they've tried to put on it. How important, though, are the results from tonight's elections going to be on what we are going to be doing here in Florida, and what does it mean for the two remaining Democratic candidates who are left?
Yeah, it kind of depends on, the how you're deciding to make your vote. If you're making your vote based off of who you think can beat Donald Trump, you know, you're going to look at primary election results as part of that. If you're, you know, where we're at now in the primary, we basically have, you know, two people that are very on opposite ends of the spectrum. I think if you're basing it off of your policies, then you're going to vote your heart regardless.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. It's coming down to, you know, as Obi suggests, you know, you have two candidates right now who are ideologically separate. What is that motivation for voters? Are they ideological warriors who are going to be the kind of people who will vote for Bernie Sanders even when the race is definitively over because their convictions are so strong? Or are they voting simply because, they want a candidate that they can personally identify with and like? For your average voter, likability is a huge thing. We as analysts seem to underplay that sometimes. You know, even myself, when I ask the question, you know, how can somebody who's in the Warren camp then endorse Joe Biden when ideologically, in terms of their policies, they're completely different? It comes down to, you know, core issues for that individual. You know, do I like the person who I'm going to be voting for? So regarding today, you know, the other thing I was thinking of, with this being, you know, let's call it, you know, with the age of these candidates, maybe Groovy Tuesday might be the best thing, because it was still striking to me. I woke up this morning thinking about coming on the program, and it still blows my mind that this entire primary field, we're looking at two candidates who are going to be, one of these two is going to be the nominee, and both of them, their next big birthday is 80. Mm. It's really, really amazing.
It makes you wonder, too, whether or not either one of these two candidates, if they win, or even, well, in Trump's case, it wouldn't be affected, but could they even think about a re-election in 4 years from now, considering what age they'll be at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes the VP pick so important. Because what that VP pick is almost a signal of, you know, where the party's going to go in the future. And so I think that's going to be more important than it has been in the past.
Yeah, it's very interesting to me. This would be one of the first elections I could honestly state that I think that if one of these two candidates, maybe particularly the Sanders campaign now as his campaign begins to flag badly, may benefit really from that kind of like that getting out in front of it and saying, oh, by the way, vote for me because I now have a ticket. Letting voters know you've got a gentleman with Sanders who's going to be 79 years old, who had a mild heart attack last fall. You know, these are legitimate concerns. And I've heard voters say, hey, listen, I like Bernie, but boy, I mean, you know, when you got that kind of condition, or Joe Biden, who for whatever reason, maybe it's just his, you know, Joe's been a lifelong stutterer. We know that he's never been a great orator, but a lot of folks have said, you know, more recently, he looks like he's really struggling to articulate his points. Is he as articulate as he used to be, and or his mental processes, you know, where they used to be? You know, really for either one of these two guys to say, hey, listen, you know, as Obi had said, you know, Kamala Harris is going to be my vice presidential candidate, or Stacey Abrams, or whomever one of those candidates out there who you would think is a younger, younger, you know, representing a different voting block than the old white guy who, once again, you know, we've kind of defaulted to that in the Democratic Party, despite that, you know, being the party of diversity, we've seen, you know, what's shaken out. You know, maybe there's some validity to that.
I do want to get into the Florida primary here in just a moment, but before doing that, let's again focus on tonight's six states. Michigan is the most important one of the six, mm-hmm. is that correct? Mm-hmm. I know they have the most number of delegates, yeah. of course, at stake.
Yeah, Michigan is the big prize tonight. I think Daniel and I were talking about this kind of before we came on. You know, for Bernie, Michigan was a strong state. But with Biden, him going one-on-one versus Biden, that's probably the worst person for him to go one-on-one with Biden in Michigan just because of Biden's role in the auto bailout,
yes.
right? You know, Biden has some baggage with the NAFTA vote, but his auto bailout has made him very popular there as well. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. If Biden can take that state and takes a few of the other states, I think it's going to be very hard for Bernie to catch up.
I agree with that. I think that the big thing for Bernie tonight, I think he has to win something. And I, whether it's, you know, North Dakota, Idaho, the state of Washington, which remains of the bigger states, he's still competitive there in terms of public polling. Mm-hmm. He's got to win something. Or at some point, you know, the whole argument for his campaign and this incredible coalition and, you know, all of the young people that he's brought out who don't vote, apparently, they may be mm-hmm. rabid on social media and maybe caustic on social media, may have a fervor, but they're not turning out at the polls. And if Bernie, just for your average person just turning into CNN at 7 o'clock and you're looking at a map of the country, if there aren't some states here that start populating in Sanders colors, you know, it's going to be really difficult for him to make an argument. Yeah. What is Sanders, you know, Hail Mary pass now? Really? I mean, as we discussed, this was getting into a one-on-one debate with Joe Biden. That's going to become a moot point if Bernie can't win some states prior to that debate.
I'm wondering how many people who will be participating, of course, in our primaries, how many people are really looking at even a larger picture than this? Because one of the things that I heard from a number of people that I follow is the concern about trying to get the Senate and turn mm-hmm. that over. So the Democrats have a very big job to do to not only get their candidate elected to the White House, but also to help those under ballots, those that are going to be running for other offices, particularly the U.S. Senate in the general election, and whether or not those coattails are going to be long enough to be able to bring some of those people on.
Yeah, I think that's the important part of a primary, right? I think the appeal of both candidates, and they're both making this in different ways, is that they're going to bring out a certain group of people to the party to vote, right? And that those votes are going to go all the way down ballot. And so what we've seen, though, with Bernie is that his coalition hasn't really come to the table yet, right? And with Biden, you've seen a little bit of actual overperformance in turnout in some of the states that he's won. I think the question now is, you know, who's going to be able to continue to bring out their voters to the table?
And I think going into the fall relative to the Senate, too, I think that if you get into another scenario like we had in 2016, listen, whether warranted or not warranted, where there's a big, you know, swath of Bernie voters who have a bad taste in their mouth after this process and they stay home. Listen, Joe Biden, for all of his strengths and all of his weaknesses, I mean, I think we would agree he is not the kind of candidate who's going to be a movement candidate, who's going to bring out a bunch of new voters to the fall. Okay. That if you're a Democrat and you're trying to calculate who may be able to help you win back the Senate, arguably that would be Bernie would be more of your selection just simply because he may. We know Joe Biden is not.
And that's the argument for Bernie. The issue is it hasn't really come out yet in voting in the primary.
Correct.
And so you have to, you know, prove, you know, have to show and prove what you're able to do. And we haven't seen that. I think Florida may be a little bit different. I think Florida, you know, Bernie's team has been on the ground for a little bit longer here. And there's a higher youth vote here in Florida that has been in some other states. And so this is an opportunity for them to show, you know, if that coalition is going to come to the table.
Right. And I think in some ways, social media participation is a really bad way to gauge likability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for every Bernie Sanders supporter who you get online with, who may attack you or who you may argue with, guess what? At the end of the day, they've got one vote just like you do. So while the voices may be loud and they may echo, In reality, it's not always the best reflection of how your average rank-and-file Democrat who's just going to go out on election day is going to perform.
Our phone number is 549-2937. You're more than welcome to join us here on the air if you have a question or a comment you'd like to make as we discuss the Florida primary, but first the six primaries that are going on today, as a matter of fact, including Michigan. The coronavirus, do you think it's going to have an impact on voter turnout today?
Yeah, I don't know if it will have an impact today. I do think it'll have an impact if this in the future. I think for the people here that are voting in Florida, go vote early. Right. You'll be around less people. I haven't voted here in a while where I've been in a bunch of crowds of people. And so I think if you can avoid the crowds, I think people want to go and vote.
Yeah, sadly, I mean, I would say, especially in early voting, no. Considering when I walked into early vote, everyone looked so excited to see me walk into the room. I think if you actually wanted to find a place that had a few people, go to your early voting site in Duval County.
It's the safest place to be
right now. It's the safest place to be right now. It'll just be you and the folks who are working there. That's pretty much it.
However, if this lingers or gets worse, it could have an impact on Florida's primary next week.
Sure. And on presidential politics at large. I mean, I would think, and, you know, again, you don't want to politicize a pandemic. You know, right. That is certainly something you don't want to do. But here again, you know, if you are the candidate, if you were an Elizabeth Warren or you were a Bernie Sanders, you know, using an example of a pandemic for why we should have universal health care in the United States as a public health threat is certainly a legitimate policy concern. You know, when you have a large Western democracy and 25% of our population in the United States either doesn't have insurance or can't afford to take off work to even go get tested, you know, there would be something there that you could politicize, even if which you'd have to be very delicate with that, because you don't want to look like you're seizing an opportunity through a pandemic. Yet there is a larger public health concern there for policy.
Yeah, and as someone who has had insurance and not had insured and have insurance again, I think when you don't have insurance, right, you are less likely to want to go to the doctor at all, right? You wanna stay home and you'll get better on your own and you'll use home remedies or whatever it is. And I think that in this kind of system, when you have a pandemic, is a problem, because you want people to go to the hospital or want people to get tested, and that's just not the nature of someone without health care.
You know, that's an interesting point, because even yesterday I was watching the news conference with the coronavirus task force, and the reporter at the very end yelled out that question, will people without insurance be able to get testing for free?
Right.
And they wouldn't answer the question. I don't think they know the answer to that yet, and they haven't really gotten that far. But that's a big issue, because you're talking then about, obviously, an entire group of Americans who are either uninsured or underinsured, and something like a test of this sort, and I have no idea what they're charging for it, but a test like that could very well make the difference between, do I pay the rent this month or do I get my test for coronavirus?
Look, Mike, they're handling our food. They're touching the same products on shelves that we are every day. There are clerks. There are folks who are working at the gate station. They're the students coming into my classroom. Mm-hmm. They're the folks that all of us are interacting with on a daily basis. And they're walking around uninsured, and they're walking around without the ability potentially to even get tested. And it's kind of a societal irony when you think about it, that, you know, eventually we'll develop caring only in as much as we want those people to get tested to take care of ourselves, because we all have insurance.
Yeah. And I think also this is another this is a voting issue. Every 4 years, there are things that you're not going to expect that are going to happen. And you, when you're picking your candidate, you know, who do you believe can handle these type of incidents, right? Because these aren't things that you're going to necessarily, we didn't talk about coronavirus in 2016, right? But we're dealing with it now. And so when people are going to the polls, and why it's important for them to go to the polls and vote in the primaries, you're picking the person that is going to have the decision-making process that you trust.
And to completely answer your question, I think that either Sanders or Biden can also draw a stark contrast to the president on this issue. When you have a president of the United States who's basically only relying on numbers, but then doesn't want to know what the accurate numbers are because he's more concerned with the stock market than when he actually is dealing with an outbreak. Again, framing this as a Democrat, okay, that, you know, there would be ammunition there from both of these candidates basically to have a very, very clear policy position from our sitting president.
Okay, we have a couple of phone calls we'd like to get on the air, and if you'd like to join us, the number once again is 549-2937. Doc is on the north side. Good morning, Doc. Welcome to the program. There we go. I'm sorry about that. Are you there? All right, let's try this line. Excuse me. Doc, are you there?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Thank you. I've figured out the buttons now. I think we're okay.
Yes, you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I'm a little appalled by the fact that, you know, before, after World War II, we were number one in education. Today, we are about 25th in education. And when I listen to what y'all say today, I'm a little disappointed here because y'all giving y'all opinion more than facts, especially come being most of y'all in the media. But my main concern here, I want to tap into the fact that why the election system in the United States take a whole almost over a year to get done, this process is with the primary. It should not last no more than 6 months, if that long. Because what the hell is disenfranchise people in this country, and then it separate people who want to be engaged. Because when we talk about civic engagement, if you are voting and you're not participating in the process after you vote, your vote have really no value.
Okay, it's
you're
an interesting
just voting
comment.
For popularity more than anything else.
Let me see if we can get our responses here, Doc. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a argument that people are starting to make about a one-day primary, right, where everybody primaries on
national
the same,
primary.
Yeah,
type
everybody
thing.
Primaries on the same day. I definitely agree with the caller to some of his points about the longer this process is, the more people are disinterested and that kind of thing. I think from a campaign, from a consultant standpoint, spreading these primaries allow more people to be involved. In order to do a one-day primary, a campaign would have to have considerable amount of money to be able to set up resources in every state and to do that on one day where they can spread that, money can come in as it goes, and they can move forward. I do think, though, you know, a lot of people dropped out before the first vote, and I don't know if that's necessarily helping the process as well.
So. Present company excluded, Doc. Let me just say that the reason it's so long is because of money. As long as there's money to be made in anything in the United States, we're going to find a way to do it. The news media makes a ton of corporate media, not NPR, mind you, make a ton of money off of elections and campaigns. And the longer you can stretch them out, the longer you can have set an agenda with a simple narrative of a horse race for who's doing what and who's going to win and who's going to where. And you can sell ads, the longer it's going to be drawn out. So that would be my recommendation, Doc, moving forward, is that if we wanted to find a way, a bipartisan way to come together and say, hey, we're going to limit this. We're going to shrink this. We're going to do some of the things that would be suggested. We're going to have to realize at the end of the day that there are going to be people who make a lot of money off the existing process who will no longer be making a lot of money or as much money.
Well, as we all know, we are down to two candidates at this point. Mm-hmm. But if you've taken a look at your sample ballot or if you've already gone to vote, you will notice that all of the Democratic mm-hmm. candidates who were running, their names are still on that ballot. The question is and one question came in, as a matter of fact, on Facebook from Emily, what happens to all the early votes for Warren? Will she get those delegates and then be able to give them to whomever she chooses at the convention? Or do they just throw all those votes away because she's no longer a candidate? Do we know the answer?
It depends upon the candidate, whether or not, you know, when they get to the convention, if they're going to release the delegates that they've earned. Yeah, they'll give instructions to their delegates and how they want to function. Or instructions to their delegate is how they would like them to cast their support into the direction of what candidate. As to the ballot, I'll be honest with you. I forgot Michael Bennett and Deval Patrick were even running. I went in to vote and I'm like, my goodness. So there was Deval Patrick got into the race the same day Michael Bloomberg did, I think. And you could just tell how swamped he was by Bloomberg mania, you know, and that $500 million that could have been spent elsewhere. But yeah.
Okay. Back to the calls. Tom is on the west side. Good morning, Tom, and thanks for joining us.
Ah, good morning to y'all, and keep sharing your opinions. I value them.
Thank you, Tom.
My comment is this. I think Joe Biden represents merely a return to the status quo, whereas Bernie Sanders offers us the opportunity to possibly move forward in some issues. I'm in my 50s now. I've only had insurance in my lifetime for a very brief period, and not likely unless this the system changes drastically, that I'll have it again in the future. So, yeah, I'd like to see some progress in that area.
You'll get it, Tom. Based on what you said, about another 10, 11, 12 years, you'll be able to get Medicare, and that'll probably be the first opportunity you have to get it. Which, again, is sad. I mean, I know that, when you get down to what's left with these two candidates, Bernie Sanders, of course, is for Medicare for All. Vice President Biden is for fixing the Affordable Care Act, going back, retooling it.
Adding a public option.
Yeah, you know. Maybe a public option, or trying to find a way to compel the states to expand Medicaid, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a great question. I am really, relative to your healthcare question, one of the reasons I'm excited about a two-person debate is to get a moderator to put this to both candidates. One, get an answer from Bernie specifically. How will you pay for Medicare for All? He's answered that in other places, but he hasn't done it in a primetime debate. And then two, to ask Vice President Biden, how will you pay for basically going back to a system that has already bankrupt us? What will you do to fix that?
And I think in Florida, healthcare, at least among Dems, is the biggest issue, right?
Yeah.
And I think...
every public poll would say
that.
Yeah,
and I think you have to... When you're going to go vote, they have very different views on how they're going to handle healthcare, right? And so one person is really kind of expanding on the current process. One person is going for something very drastically different. And I think the voters get to decide, right? I think the voters get to decide which process they feel the most comfortable moving forward with.
And also remember this, if you go back to the Affordable Care Act as a model, if that's the way we want to go back, then you're also going to be, in order to fund it, because this is the way that pooled insurance works, risk insurance, you're going to have to bring back that individual mandate, which we know is unpopular with people of all political stripes. So that would also have to be something that would be revisited.
Tom, thank you very much for your question. If you go back 4 years ago, and I remember quite vividly the Democratic Convention and how the superdelegates played such an important role in Hillary getting the nomination, because after the first vote, even though nobody got a majority of them, there's no question that Bernie was doing very well at that point.
Right.
And also a number of the states that he had won with their delegates had superdelegates that ended up throwing the race over to Hillary. First of all, how are superdelegates even selected?
Yeah, superdelegates are really selected by the party as a whole. They're usually, they're like the elected officials, and then kind of either retired officials or big donors. The process has changed since then, thanks to Bernie. Bernie has changed the process, or asked for a different process where, the regular delegates vote first by themselves, and then the superdelegates vote second if there's no majority. And so that's the process that, Bernie kind of fought for. And so that's the current process, and the superdelegates still have a big say, especially if no one can get a majority.
Point of clarification, Bernie fought for that, but that was actually the compromise position. Bernie wanted the superdelegates eliminated. That was what he went to this, why do we have literally, I forget the exact number, 600 or 640 kingmakers basically floating around out there with VIP passes to special booths at the convention, being wooed and awed in order to get their support, versus just that average rank and file Democratic, working stiff who goes out there and votes. The process, as it'll be described, it is absolutely correct. They're not going to have as much input this time around if one of the candidates can get a majority of the votes on the first ballot. I think that we would be in agreement, though, that if it were to come down to a second ballot, the majority of the superdelegates are going to fall in line with the party establishment, and support Vice President Biden.
Which
is why it's so important to go out and vote in your Florida primary, right? Because the delegates are given out proportionally. So if you are for your person, go out and vote, because you want to make sure they get as many delegates as possible, because when they get to the convention, that's where the real drama is going to begin. But you want to give them the most bargaining power as possible.
I tell my students all the time, I know they're busy. A lot of them, go to FSCJ. They work two jobs. They're trying to do the best that they can. But with 8 days of early voting and with basically no lines here in Duval County, there's really no excuse for not finding a little bit of time and getting out there to vote. It only takes you a second. I mean, my ballot only had one question on my presidential preference, and it takes literally 2 minutes.
We only have a couple of minutes left. We do have a couple of minutes for calls if you'd like to get them in here at 549-2937. One issue which we definitely wanted to make sure that we addressed, and somebody just wrote it in on Facebook as well, the news release that came out last week, the Duval County Democratic Executive Committee and the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville releasing the following statement, and that is they want to know why the Supervisor of Elections decided to close the early voting sites at universities and colleges here in Jacksonville. We did, by the way, make a phone call to Mr. Hogan, Mike Hogan, our Supervisor of Elections, to see if he could join us this morning to talk a little bit about that. But he's unavailable. He's working with canvassing at this point. But what does that mean? First of all, why do you think the decision was made to close those specific polling places? And how is that going to impact, do you believe, on the results next Tuesday?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't speak for Mike Hogan. I guess the reasoning that was given was that those were lower performing sites. I don't agree with that. I think I think we want more people to vote. You have more places to vote. I think it's just as simple as that. I think taking away younger voters has been more Democrats are younger voters. And so maybe that's part of the reasoning why. But I definitely think it's sad that we can't have those on those college campuses.
That's right. If you're going to, basically say they're lower performing sites, then the public deserves to find out what metric you've used to evaluate mm-hmm. that. Just to say, hey, they're lower performing based on what? Well, how did you arrive at that decision? Are you certain that these are the lowest performing sites within the city or within Duval County? I mean, you've really kind of got to be transparent with what the methodology is. Or it's just, if nothing else, even if it was well-intended, you're going to give rise to rumor about why those sites in those locations were closed.
But also, if you've been here a while, those are the newest sites as well. They're not, it takes time for people to, if you've a consistent early voter, you go to the same place and you early vote every time. It takes time for people to even be aware of those polling sites. And so you take the two newest ones and then you get rid of them without really giving them enough time for people to even know that they exist.
And guess what? Even if you were to bring them back now, you're only adding another layer of uncertainty. Excuse me. Can I vote there? Or can I not vote there? Is this the election I can vote on campus? Is this not the election I can vote on campus?
Right.
All that does is fuel it.
Right.
Either of you would like to make a prediction about next Tuesday?
In Florida or tonight?
Let's start with Florida next week and we can come back to it.
Unless the trajectory changes somehow, I think it's going to be a big night here for Joe Biden in Florida.
Yeah, I think Joe Biden will win here, but I also think the Bernie people are going to do better than they've been doing in the polling. Both campaigns are really ramping up here. The Bernie people have been on the ground for a while. They've been knocking on doors. The Biden campaign is bringing out Joe Biden this week. So both campaigns are moving in Florida, but I think Biden will edge him out, but I think Bernie will do better than he's been polling here in Florida.
What about tonight?
I think it's going to be, again, another big night for Biden. As I said previously, Bernie's got to win somewhere, even if it's North Dakota or Idaho. He's got to be able to put a couple states on that map and whatever color graphic that they're using on the main TV networks. I think if he could win Washington, that'd be great. And however he can minimize the damage in Michigan or Missouri, because the last polling I looked at this morning, he was down big there. So, hey, but then again, maybe he can overperform those numbers and he can come out and say, listen, the last poll in Michigan had me down by 30 points and I only lost by 3 points or whatever the case may be.
Same. I think the same as Daniel on what's going to happen tonight. I think Biden wins the big prizes. And hopefully, if Bernie wants to stay in it, he'll be able to pull out a couple states.
He's got to stay relevant, Mike, until he can get Biden alone on that debate stage, mm-hmm. I think is Bernie's best chance to make an impact in this race.
And by the way, if you'd like to know where you go to vote, either early or next Tuesday in the primary, we want to make sure that if you're in Duval, St. John's County, and elsewhere, anywhere on the First Coast, go to www.jct.org/elections. And we've got all the information on our website for you to be able to get the answers that you need. And if we don't answer those questions, there are phone numbers you can call to get more information, including from the Supervisor of Elections office. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. We'll see what happens. I appreciate the insight and the answers to the questions that we all had.
Thank you for having me on.
Go vote.
Yes, indeed. Up next, honoring the critical contribution nurses and midwives make to global health.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Electro Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
WJCT invites you to join us for an evening with Ari Shapiro on Thursday, April 2nd. Award-winning journalist and weekday co-host of All Things Considered, NPR's award-winning afternoon news program, will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, for an engaging conversation. Visit wjct.org/events for ticket information. Sponsored by the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida.
Okay, welcome back. The World Health Organization, or WHO, has declared 2020 the year of the nurse and the midwife. It did so to coincide with the 200th anniversary of the birth of Florence Nightingale. Here now with more on this is Mary Marcus, who is a registered nurse. Lily Lauries, I believe it's pronounced, if I'm not mistaken, who's director of the UNF School of Nursing, and Diane Pagano, who's the dean of nursing at the St. John's River State College. Thank you all for joining us. Nice to have you with us. If you'd like to join us in conversation, our telephone number is 549-2937, or you can join us on Facebook, or you can join us, if you'd like, by on our Twitter page. The 200th anniversary of the birth of Florence Nightingale, how many years or how many times have we taken this particular event and made a celebration out of it? Or is it only because it's the 200th year? And whoever would like to start on that.
Well, I wouldn't say we've had a lot of them. We need more, actually. But what it's really about is changing the role of nurses, having them more active in healthcare, having them participating. They have five directives where nurses should be more involved in healthcare and in healthcare policy. For me, I graduated from my diploma school, Bellevue Hospital School of Nursing, very historic, and it was founded in the late 1800s, with Florence Nightingale. Dr. Wiley was in correspondence with Florence Nightingale, and the correspondence is actually in her museum in London. So we have a direct connection. Our school ended, unfortunately, in 1969. And at that time, nursing education really focused on function. We were straight out of high school, young. We lived. We had a 40-hour week. We lived at the residence. We had a front desk we signed in. We pretty much were under a rigid system. And basically, we didn't have much autonomy. The doctor said, when what was wrong with the patient, we weren't allowed to give diagnosis, weren't allowed to give meds, but our education was very much like what you see in the college courses. We had PhDs and master's prepared people teaching us anatomy, physiology, pharmacology, all of that. So there wasn't a function we did like giving shots without knowing the science behind it. That changed as time went on. And where there was no career ladder for us, there was no PhD possibilities, no autonomy, gradually it segued into what these two ladies have here, collegiate programs that they're directors of. And they probably can speak to that part of the education.
Please, you want to go ahead?
So at St. John's River State College, we have several programs all the way from a certified nursing assistant up to a bachelor's program. And we offer alternate pathways into the becoming a nurse so that if you struggled in the beginning and took some college courses at 18, maybe didn't do well, you can certainly come back. There's different pathways in through an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree. And we give preference to folks that start in some of our lower programs and work their way up into the baccalaureate system.
And at UNF, we have a bachelor program for entry level, and we also have a doctor of nursing practice program where you have nurse practitioners or you can become a nurse anesthesiologist through those programs. I wanted to mention the importance of the correlation of Florence Nightingale's 200th birthday and calling it the Year of the Nurse, is that Florence Nightingale, she really, she was a we know she was unique, and she really emphasized aseptic technique. She emphasized nurses being a leader for the patient care. And when you look at the what the Year of the Nurse, what WHO is calling for nurses, is for them to be leaders in the healthcare of patients and for them to be able to take care of the challenges that we're facing now with healthcare.
The restrictions that are placed on nurses, and I assume midwives as well, as Mary was talking about here a moment ago, is this a function of the state governments to broaden those responsibilities, or is that a federal issue, or is it the AMA? Who makes the decision as to what nurses can perform and can't perform?
Actually, the Institute of Medicine report back in 2010 asked for all nurses to be able to function at their highest level of education. The restrictive, each state has, the Board of Nursing of each state has restrictions as to what the license entails them to do. Bachelor's prepared nurses or registered nurses, because that's where the license stands, it's mm-hmm. registered nurse. You could be an associate degree nurse and be a registered nurse, or you can be a bachelor's degree nurse and be a registered nurse. They have the same restriction, and that's more practicing at the bedside, although we're seeing that they're developing into doing extended practice now that we're looking at getting them to their full scope. When you go to the nurse practitioner level or the midwife level or the nurse anesthesiologist level, those are more controlled by the Board of Nursing as well, but also the Board of Medicine, because they practice somewhat in medicine and somewhat in nursing, and that's where the restrictions come. And that's where we have the biggest variation in scope of practice, is at the advanced practice level, where each state has different legislatures.
I read that nurses and midwives account for nearly 50% of the global health workforce. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mary just tapped him.
Mary just tapped me to make sure I saw that she was in agreement. 50%.
50%.
So, yes. But I've also read that there have been shortages of nurses. And is that, I presume that's the issue worldwide when it comes to a global issue, but is that the same case here in Florida, for instance? Do we have a shortage of nurses in Florida and in Jacksonville as well?
Oh, yes.
I can
Absolutely.
Tell you that we are all evaluated on our outcomes, and one of the outcomes we're evaluated on is employability as well as passing the NCLEX. So we need to make sure that we're putting out nurses who can graduate but also who are employed within 6 months. And I can tell you that probably both our schools are right around 100% employability, mm-hmm. Which shows the need within 6 months of graduation.
I was going to say that we are projecting a shortage of it goes in waves, and we're projecting another shortage coming up probably in 5 to 10 years. And that has to do in particular with retirement of nurses. Because the nursing workforce, I think the average age is 53 years of age. So when you think of 53-year-old working at the bedside taking care of patients, they're tired. And nurses that are coming into the profession are, because of the stressors of the job, they're not staying in the profession. So we're losing them there as well. So that is going to create, and then we also have a population that's growing older, so we have more people needing healthcare, so we're going to need nurses just there. But then if we're losing what we have, that is increasing the need. So we're going to be seeing another severe shortage of nurses.
Now, the two of you represent, obviously, state colleges, FSCJ and UNF, but there are a number of private colleges that are
Correct.
Here as well as elsewhere, and many of them, I understand, specialize in nursing or have separate nursing curricula. How are they doing as far as filling up their classrooms and finding people to enroll into their programs?
Sure. So we're all evaluated on the same metrics. So we all need to look at how our students do passing the NCLEX, how they do with employability skills, and how they do with maintaining their progression through the program. We can't have 200 people start the program and only finish with 100. So we need to show that we're selecting the right people at the beginning, that they're completing our programs, they're graduating, they're passing the boards, and that they're employable, and then our job is done there.
But you bring up a good point. I went to a diploma school, and the focus then was on function. In other words, we spent 2 years, 9 months, 40 hours a week, and we were able to segue very smoothly into going out and doing the job. Theory and practice, we didn't give a shot without knowing the science behind it. And now there isn't as much time, and clinical sites are not always easy to get. So getting the clinical experience is the biggest downfall. In other words, you teach someone something, how are they integrating it in terms of going out and doing it? And you need a really strong clinical to go with it. And that's what makes our education and medical school, a few others, so unique. It isn't learning English and writing a paper. It's actually sitting in the class, passing tests, and then going out and giving an injection and understanding why you're doing it and being faithful to the technique in doing it. And that's what makes it so expensive and so difficult and so hard for students, pulling that theory and then going on the hospital unit and actually performing the task and understanding what they're doing.
You could just imagine how closely we have to work between the schools and the community partners, the hospitals, the other healthcare agencies, where we rely on them for clinical placement. They rely on our graduates to help staff their facilities.
We only have a couple of moments left, and I did want to ask one question as we've been talking about this being the year of the nurse and the midwife. What is the difference between the two? Who would like to address that?
Well, a midwife is a slightly different role within nursing. And a midwife in other countries is probably a lot more recognized than it is here. But a midwife is a person that's, and I'm saying a person because it could be a male, that has been prepared and educated to help with the birthing and with the taking care of that immediate neonatal part. So it's throughout the pregnancy and delivery and the postnatal part. And that's where the midwives, in particular in some of the European countries, some of African nations, where you really use the midwife because of the lack of providers in the areas, and in particular in rural areas. And a nurse is your RN that you see at the bedside.
Right. So it's a specialty. Being a midwife is a specialty. You actually go in and follow the woman through her pregnancy and delivery. And so that's the basic. And they don't go into a general hospital and do surgical nursing.
But the curriculum is different as well.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
But it's beyond the normal. First they do the regular, and then they go into the specialty.
Okay. Ladies, thank you very much. Congratulations on this year of yours.
Thank
we
you.
Can say.
Thank you. Thank
nurses
you.
And midwives, and we appreciate you coming on today. Thank
and
you.
Thank you.
Up next, this month's First Coast Connect Book Club pick.
The Jacksonville Symphony is one of only four orchestras selected to perform at the Kennedy Center's prestigious Shift Festival. The concert we'll perform at Shift features two pieces written about Jacksonville: Duke Ellington's Celebration, written for the city's 150th anniversary, and Courtney Bryan's Bridges. The concert also features the return of the New York Philharmonic's principal clarinetist Anthony McGill, March 20th and 21st. Tickets and more at jacksymphony.org.
We have reached, I think, peak disinfection.
We're also encouraging our clients to wipe their own masks, providing a lot more wipes across studios, multiple locations, Lysol available for everyone.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The work of staying sanitized and virus-free next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Voters in six more states head to the polls with more crucial delegates at stake.
Let us win the Democratic nomination and let us transform this country.
will one candidate emerge as the clear frontrunner to face President Trump?
We're better than this moment, and we're better than this president.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Join us for live special coverage of Big Tuesday from NPR News.
This evening at 8 here on 89.9 WJCT.
For weeks, Wall Street has struggled to put a price on the impact of coronavirus. Now it has a new crisis to deal with, the price of oil. Who loses most in this global game of financial and political poker? And if OPEC, the once feared cartel, can't act, who will? I'm Todd Zwillick. The latest next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Stacey Goldring, our First Coast Connect Book Club facilitator, is here now with this month's selection, Winesburg, Ohio, by Sherwood Anderson. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Mike. And let me say, it is such a pleasure to hear your voice on the radio because I used to live in Boca.
Oh, okay.
And for years, I heard you every afternoon, and it's just wonderful to hear you back on
air.
Well,
thank you very much. I appreciate that. It seems like it was a century ago.
No.
Fact, it was, because it was in the
1900s. This is true. No, it was just yesterday.
I'm glad to hear that. Neither of us have grown any older, correct?
No, not at all.
Tell us about Winesburg.
I'm going to tell you about Winesburg, Ohio, because, Mike, it's a book we all should read. Because it is a book that has probably influenced any of the great authors that you find on your favorite list, such as John Steinbeck was influenced by Winesburg, Ohio. In fact, he said that the American novel began and pretty much ended with Winesburg. So why have we never ever heard of really Winesburg, Ohio? I know very few people that have heard of Winesburg or the author, Sherwood Anderson. So it is my goal here today to try to right that wrong, because clearly Sherwood Anderson didn't have a great PR firm to keep him on our radar. And this happens with a lot of books. Books go in and out of fashion, in and out of style, depending on what's happening in our society. Mm-hmm. For instance, I've talked about other books in the past, such as Passing by Nella Larsen, that really highlights the Harlem Renaissance, which fell in and out of fashion, and now it's finally being recognized. Another book is Uncle Tom's Cabin, which used to be banned, or it was praised, whatever, but just like bell bottoms and perms, things go in and out of style, right? So what I'm trying to do is take Winesburg, Ohio, and put it on that classic level here today. The book came out in 1919, so what's so special about it? Well, if we think about that time in history, America is in a time of transition.
That's right after the war to end all wars, correct?
That's right. World War That's I. right. And we have people that are living at that time that are Civil War vets. They've survived, you know, the Civil War. We are going from an agrarian rural society to one based on banking and manufacturing, industrialization. Our world is in a period, our country, transition and upheaval. So our author takes a look at Winesburg, Ohio, which it does exist on a map, but this is a metaphorical view of America. And he says, you know what? I've been reading a lot about this guy, Freud. And Freud is also coming to America at this time. He's actually doing a lecture circuit. And you know what he's talking about? He's talking about sex.
Mm-hmm.
And our author is also seeing the repression of living in a small town and how society's restrictions smother us as individuals and who we are. So he takes all of these elements and he presents them to us in a series of about 22 characters. We have about 22 vignettes that are told to us through a main character who is what? A journalist. We have a little newspaper reporter named George who writes for the Winesburg Eagle. And all these individuals in the town come to him at some point through each chapter, and they reveal their failures. They reveal why they never can marry, why they failed at their job, why they never left and went to the big city. And we all have these failures, but the question is, what do we do with them? And through the book, we see how George learns kind of what not to do in order to succeed. And that's what we do, right? If we have a failure, we have a choice.
Right.
And that's exactly why the book is still relevant today. When I think about the virus, what are we going to do, right? Are we going to let it define who we are, the fear, et cetera? Or are we going to become smarter, wiser, stronger as a result of it? So even though 1919, I would say in 2020, incredibly relevant today.
I have to ask this question, obviously. Is there a Winesburg, Ohio?
There is. Being okay. that I am from Ohio,
all right.
I can tell you that I can tell you there is a Winesburg, but no one knows why he chose that title. However, there's a map at the beginning of the book, and it is not a map of the Winesburg that actually exists, but of Clyde, Ohio, where our author grew up. So he bases it on that.
Stacy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you coming on. Is the book available, by the way, locally?
The book is available at San Marco Books and More. I'll be talking about it tonight at the bookstore at 6:30. The public is welcome to attend. And tomorrow, I'll be at the Comer with Cindy Edelman to talk about this book further at noon. And I hope you'll join us there.
Very good. Thank you so much for being with us. That's our program. Thank you to all of our guests as well as the callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Colombo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Meanwhile, I'm Mike Miller sitting in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be back here again tomorrow morning. Let's connect again then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.